Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very, very special guest and very exciting. I just read her two books. Her name is Amy Daughters. She is an author, obviously, of two books. She is a mother, a sister, a wife, and a friend. She's a humorous sports writer. And like I said, she's the author of two books. One is You Cannot Mess This Up. That was published in 2019. And Dear Dana, that was published in 2022. And we are going to discuss her books. I can't wait. So I get the fun job, and I don't know if this makes me a nerd, but I get to read people's books and then ask them questions. Who else gets to do that, right? It's ridiculous. Okay. And here is Amy.
Greetings.
All right. So I don't know which book I want to start with. I read them both at the same time. So I was going back and forth in life, you know? All right, let's do the first one because I just have to say. So You Cannot Mess This Up. So let me say it. So Amy's taking a plane, right? You're taking a plane to go to your family's house for Thanksgiving, and you had to meet with your father. I don't know, it was the death talk or something like that to discuss, you know, that. And then all of a sudden, I think it was on the plane, you're dressed in polyester from the, was it 70s or the 80s?
70s? 1978 is to say, yeah.
Okay, 1978. So all of a sudden, her clothes have changed to polyester. Her bags are different. Everything's different. The plane is different, right? And she goes back in time. Now, what I have to say about this book is it was real for me. It wasn't like I had to keep remembering that you made it up, like you wrote it. It's fiction, but it was so, and I was telling a friend about it, and she's like, so she really time traveled? And I was like, no, she actually didn't do it, but it just was so, like, I give you so much credit to be able to make it so real.
Well, thank you. That's very humbling. And you know, I spent a couple weekends away. I had small kids at the time when I wrote the book. And there was this, I lived in Ohio at the time, and there was a 70s resort near where we live. So I booked a room, like, you know, when you have little kids, it's a big deal if you get to go somewhere. And I booked a room like several weekends, not in a row. And I put myself in this 70s hotel room, like went to dinner by myself. But I had the VCR, the tapes, and the pictures. And I surrounded myself with all this stuff. And I think that's where I feel like I transported myself, and I'm not a crazy person. I feel like I had that journey on a bunch of different levels for me that I manufactured this time travel.
Yeah. I mean, it was just between the bulges of the men. I mean, but again, I graduated high school in 77, so I'm just giving away my age. But so I wasn't that young, but I don't remember looking for that. Let's put it that way. If they had that, like, how did you even come up with that?
Well, that was, I love history and I love nostalgic things. So the biggest joy of this whole book, other than the humor, was the research. And I didn't do it like research sounds like, you know, I was, you know, in a business suit in somebody's office. Yeah. Research was me, was the Houston Public Library, was YouTube, was I bought Sears catalogs, and I just dove in and loved every minute of it. So the man bulge is really, it was the Sears catalog and the YouTube videos. I was like, wait a second, that needs to be like size up for, I mean, a size down friends or whatever it is to make that, you know, because I was looking at pants and I imagined walking in and seeing my dad at the same age as me. And I was like, wait a second, I'm going to see things I shan't see. And I saw them, you know, like a bulge, you know,
yeah.
Bulge, tight.
Yeah.
So, all right. So she's wearing the clothes. She goes into, can I tell this? It's just fun.
Oh, yeah.
She goes into her old house. She gets driven to her old house and she goes in as her 46-year-old self. And how old was little Amy? So there was big Amy and little Amy.
And little Amy was 10. Yeah.
9.
Yeah. 10 years old. So she, yeah. And so they thought I was a distant cousin. You know, so they knew that they were related to me somehow, but they had no idea that I was the adult version of this kid, this off the chain kid that they were raising. And mom and I, dad and I were the same age in the story, which also I wrote it because I thought I was going to be funny, haha girl, and write a funny back in time book. But then I realized, oh my gosh, look at all this emotions, like feelings.com. I was going to have to like unlayer and re-remember, you know, based on what I thought was going to be. The book is funny, but it also has a lot of depth to it that I didn't expect to, you know, going into the project. That wasn't my expectation. People have asked me, did you work with a therapist? I was like, no, I did not work with a therapist. I worked with a Sears catalog.
So, all right, I got a lot of things to unpack, as they say. Okay. Which one do I start with? Okay, I'll just go in order. So the feeling. So which, I don't even know which book it was in, but that when you go back, like when your sister-in-law said, let's talk about that, when your mother was upset.
Right, right.
And you guys don't do that. So how do you get from not doing it to writing this book? Or was that why it was so helpful? Because you could get in touch.
Right. And I think it worked because I wasn't intentionally looking to do that.
Okay.
You know, but I when I began to shape the story, I was like, oh, wait, I'm looking at mom as the same age as me, only she's in 1978 and she doesn't have the internet. And she doesn't have the freedom that I do as a woman to do things, to explore writing or explore different options. She's just trying to survive this. My dad is my hero, but this is really what she wants, is this suburban lifestyle where everybody thinks she's living the dream. You know, and then I looked at myself and I was like, wait a second, this kid is off the chain. Like, I watched the videotapes, Hillary, of myself at that age. And I was like, oh my God, please stop. Someone stop her. Like, someone sit on her, because she needed like ADHD medicine and didn't even know it because there wasn't any, you know. And it was just a natural progression. All the feelings were a natural progression. So in writing the story, I went from, please stop doing that, oh my God, you're embarrassing all of us with your bowl cut and your hyperness, to at the end being like, maybe she's the most sane one in the whole household. And I, you know, all look at all the great things of her being herself. And that all got lived away in the adult version of me. So I went from wanting to run from her, like, get me away from her, to I ended writing that book. I was like, I want to be more like her. I want to honor her. I want to honor us the rest of my life. And highlight some of those things that are still somewhere inside of me. And so that's a whole like therapeutic inner child experience I had from writing this book.
So yeah, that was my next thing, was how did you know that she, you know, like, you kept calling your younger self a freak and oh my God. So you were watching video, I don't know what we called them then, but so you actually had family footage that you could watch.
Right. Dad had the 8mm Bell and Howe, and mom put it on VHS like in the 80s so when I wrote this book, I didn't have DVDs, I just had VHS tapes, which they had stuff all the way from, you know, when we were, you know, 4 or 5 to when we were 12 or 13. And so I kind of zeroed in on the 9 to 11, and it wasn't a bunch, but there was just enough. And there was this one scene where I was wearing this Christmas costume. Like, I was somebody like a medieval Christmas person. I'm wearing these tights and this woman comes to visit our house. And I'm literally like in her face, flailing around and jumping around. And this poor woman's just smiling, trying, like, people, everybody else in the film is normal. And here come, I'm just flying through here. And that was a big, that was really reflected in the first time I saw myself in the book as a young person. I was like, wait a second. That was all from that video little thing that I watched. That scene.
Yeah, because I was wondering, how did you even know that you were that way? But okay, so that explains that. And then, okay, did you discuss any of it with your mom as you were writing it or after? Like, all that stuff?
Yeah, it's a great question, because there's a lot of stuff in the book. Because what I came up with is, mom and I, like a lot of moms and daughters, we struggled in my childhood, and though not unusual, it was never unpacked previously. And you know, the editor I worked with, once I had my million word manuscript, she was like, "Wait, you can't just leave people hanging here. Like, you've got to say more in certain parts." And that was really, really hard for me. And it made me wonder if this is something I really want to do. But yes, I did talk to my mom. But when I talked to her when I was writing the book, I asked her questions about what it was like with my grandparents, what it was like with dad, what it was like for her, like what was her experience. We didn't discuss me and her until after the book, which is in the epilogue of the book. We had a real 4-minute conversation after the book. But my dad kept telling me, don't ask for permission. Just do what you got to do. But I think he was familiar with what the emotional landscape of the situation was, and he thought I should just do it. But oh my gosh, when it was about to come out, I mean, I let him read it, and it was incredibly difficult. My brother and sister thought it was hilarious. My dad liked it, and mom had the grace she loved the parts where I investigated, like, how happy was she? This was the suburban dream, only was it her dream. The way I looked around was like, how did she get all this done? And no one's even said thank you for anything she's done. And I looked at her as this woman, a similar-aged woman who was surviving this thing. She didn't even really have girls' trips or anything we do now. She was just – so she loved that part, but we never really talked about the hard parts until I went over to her house one day and just sat down and said, you read the book. This is what I remember. She refuted some of – not what was in the book, but some of what I said about whether I was the least favorite or not. But we agreed that – We just agreed that we both had our own memories about it. We both cried, which we don't do. But there was something magical about, like, transporting ourselves to the land of honesty. Like, me saying what I thought out loud, her saying her reaction to it out loud, it changed the trajectory of our relationship for and she's still living. She's 85. And now we talk every day.
Wow. Okay. This might be taboo, however. You said there was a thing that happened.
Yes.
Well, but there was. You didn't discuss it, and I don't know if you want to or.
Oh, the things that happened with mom that I didn't.
Well,
discuss?
It seemed like there was one specific thing that was referred to several. I don't know if I'm accurate, but it seemed like it was referred to several times, but it wasn't ever mentioned.
Right. So it wasn't mentioned directly. There was some incidents in high school that happened that where things got very physical and like went off the chain when there was, you know,
with her
alcohol, when there was alcohol involved with her and things escalated. And I think that's what you're referring to. I say things are going to escalate later when I'm looking at little Amy thinking, how is she going to handle all this? And there was a couple very like dramatic, like ugly scenes that happened that did not happen in the time period of the book, because the book is like a memoir wrapped up in the tortilla of time travel.
Right.
That's what makes it
hours. Yeah.
Right. It's a fictional book because of the time travel. You know, it won an award for best time travel fiction. And we all laughed about that because you're like, as opposed to the nonfiction time travel, those are the ones that really happened, you know, but so it gave me this incredible leeway to, you know, write about a bunch of memories I had, but then put words in people's mouths and then they're left reading and thinking, well, what's real and what's not real. So it gave me a lot of, you know, creative license that you normally don't get when you write a memoir, because I could hide it behind this tortilla of time travel.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, I mean, did you talk to her about when she made that Thanksgiving dinner? And now, was it a real dinner? I don't know. Probably it was like the others. And then, you know, she gets abused. Now, I was getting confused between the grandparents. The one that was so mean was her own mother?
Her own mother. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, I mean, that's the other realization I came to in the book is, oh, my God, this woman's just trying to survive. And she's also trying to keep my 10-year-old self. She needed me to be in this box because she needed to fit in with her own mother and all these people who had all these expectations of her. You know, in 1978, things were a lot, you know, simpler in the way everybody had to just do what they were supposed to do. You couldn't do anything else. And so she needed me. That part of her reaction to me, I've learned since writing the book, was she just needed me desperately to stay in line because she was struggling enough on her own where she didn't need bowl cut girl out, you know, taking her clothes off and running naked through the house. You know, yeah, exactly.
Wow. But then to not get appreciated for that dinner instead, whatever they said, the green bean, I don't know, you know, was like, wow.
Right. And I think that was her reality. And she told me when I was writing the book that she has always struggled with the holidays because she felt like she never achieved the moment. And so that's, I wrote it that way because of that. And that's the thing she loved about the book. I think she felt seen, yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and she's apologized to me numerous times since the book, which is not really gratifying for me because I don't, that makes me feel bad, you know, and it doesn't, but it also, it's this process we've gone through together in a relationship, you know, this process yeah. that we've gone through since the book. And it just, it, the book was never intended to be that, but what a gift the book yeah. has been to me.
Wow. Now, you had mentioned the drink. I mean, the drink, it was just fun. Well, I don't know if it was funny, but, you know, every time someone came by, your father was like, let me get you a drink, you know, and it's yeah. then 3 a.m. and they're still doing it. Did she ever stop drinking or did it become a problem or?
It became a problem. And then as she got older, it began to subside, you know, and now she's, you know, she's got her box of Franzia. She drinks one glass a night and she's good. And she's completely in control of herself. And I think that a lot of it was probably a reaction to the fact that she was in this pressure cooker. None of us understood. And, you know, I saw a lot of that. Because if you think about if you were going to re-remember your childhood memories, only you were going to watch them like in front of you, not on a screen. Mm-hmm. And you were going to watch them play out. But then you were going to have all the stuff that you experienced as someone between the ages of 10 and like 48. You were going to come into that same home with all the stuff you figured out on your own in your real life. And you're going to be like, wait a second. That's not what, that's what happened. But that's, we didn't have to feel that way because we didn't have that perspective. And it's not that little Amy, she was just naive and didn't have those experiences, you know, but I realized that memories are malleable and it really comes down to the person who's remembering them. And there's something powerful and freeing about that because it lets everyone, including yourself, off the hook. Like, right. Like the bottom line is just like right now and what you're doing, I'm doing, we're doing the best we can. That's what my mother was doing. She was doing the best she can. Did she get it all 100% right? No. Did I get it all 100% right? Absolutely not. You know, and that's what being human beings are though.
Right. And what's, I always say, what's right? There's no book of right. Mm-mm. That we can compare ourselves to, right?
No.
And everybody has a different version.
Right. Right. And I think that's what's so relatable about the book, because it's obvious you're going to put yourself in big Amy and little Amy's shoes. Mm-hmm. And that's why I love to talk about it, because people want to talk about what that'd be like for their experience. And I think that if there's so much healing in even thinking yourself through the same process. And again, I didn't see that as being, I thought people were just going to laugh and like spit drinks out while they were drinking. And I do think it's very funny. And that's my yeah. favorite part. But I do think on another level, it is almost cathartic. The storyline is.
Yeah. Now, question. Weird question, but maybe not. Why did you put in the almost rape scene?
I put that in because I've been asked that question a lot. I wanted to show the extreme that we as a family would go to in not telling anyone else something that happened, even if it was horrible. And I thought it was such a sign of the times, because as I discussed the story, people like, they were like, no, we didn't talk about our feelings either. Like, we didn't discuss anything that happened that was real. And so I think that showed on an adult level, like we had all the kid examples, but on an adult level, this is how ingrained this is. Like, I went in that half bath after that scene and said, I'm not telling anybody this. I won't ever tell anybody. And I think it also, and I was, this was before the, well, I'm sure it was at the beginning of the Me Too movement. And that wasn't a motivator for me at all, but it does tie in the storyline that there's all these stories that as women, as people that we've never told anybody.
And did that really happen to you?
It didn't happen to that extreme, but as a young working person, I had two incidents, and I didn't write it for that reason though, that I've had.
Right. No, I'm just, I mean, I.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a common experience.
It was just the way it was, you know right. what I mean? Like.
Yeah. No, then mine was too. And then I had a coworker who was, and yeah, but I wrote it because I just wanted, because I think I was, I think again, it was part of this catharsis for me that I saw in myself and I saw how harmful it was that I had never shared any of this stuff with anybody.
Yeah.
And so I made that as an example that didn't have anything to do with my right. memories, like an adult memory. And that could have very well happened. And the guy who I used from my memory to do that is someone who my mother told me when I was writing the book hit on her, like inappropriately. Yeah. So it all ties back together. I've had a lot of people tell me that scene doesn't fit. And the narrative of the story, it does for me.
It does. But, yeah, it does. Yeah. That you didn't tell anyone.
Right. That's the whole purpose.
Now, okay, one more question. How did you, the conversations that people had and the way people acted and stuff, it just seemed so real. How did you do that? Or is that just your gift to be able to write like that?
Well, you know, people told me that after the book came out, and I was like, because I didn't know I could write dialogue. Like, I hadn't, and I'm not professionally trained to write. I have a business degree, and I kind of fell into writing because we moved out of the country and I was desperate for something to do and I didn't have a work visa. That's the true story of how I became a writer. But I didn't know I could do that. And it's such a compliment and I appreciate it, you know, and I don't know. I think you're right. I think it's just something I have within me that I would have never known about.
Wow. And did you start talking more about stuff after the book and emotions and stuff?
Oh, absolutely. And my brother and sister and I have talked more. You know, my dad and I talked more. And, you know, my dad, who was my absolute hero, like he was, you know, my BFF in a lot of ways. He was the last person when I did this drive-by binder throw when I gave him the book because I was so scared for them to read it, the other four members of our party. And so he was the last one to read it. And he read it and he sent me this beautiful text, I loved. It was like a trip back in time for me too. I think you handle the delicate matters really well. I'd say more, but we don't talk about our feelings. Love, Dad. And then he'd always put the dog emoji, like the puppy dog emoji, dog emoji, you know, blah, 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 all these dogs. And then the book went to print that next week and Dad died suddenly. He just passed away. And so the last text I have from my father is that text. That's how we ended it. And how beautiful, and had my friends not encouraged me to throw the binders out my window on the way back to Ohio that Christmas, at the end of that Christmas, I would have never had that text. And it just, to me, that's everything, because he missed everything after that, but it doesn't really, he read the story and that kind of got his little seal of approval. So.
So what did he die of?
He had sepsis and then he had some strokes. It was like this perfect storm and like a sinus infection that might've been COVID. I mean, it was right before that. It was 2019. Oh. And so all this stuff happened. And he's the guy who went from literally he could run still. He was 78 and then he just went, just literally within 24 hours was gone. Yeah. Wow. So yeah, I mean, awful, but I do feel like, again, it's just a gift of knowing he knew the story.
Yeah.
And the rest of my life, I'll be thankful for that.
Wow. Yeah. He sounds like a great guy. Okay. One last question about that. Okay. When he makes you coffee and your mother
gets all, that's such a real scene. That's that could have really happened 3 years ago. I mean, he's been for life.
I'm so related to her. You know, she's you never made me a cup and here you're making the guest cup. What about that? Anything you want to say about that, though?
Well, thank you for picking up on that scene, because that's a great, and I love how there's a line after that and it's I'm in my own internal monologue, which is a lot of the book, and I'm talking about men, how they can make us so happy and make us want to jump off the side of a building, and too bad they're all unstable and we're totally stable. It's a great little line, but I love that scene because that scene's written straight out of my parents' marriage, that I witnessed all those years. Obviously I didn't witness that in 1978, but I've seen that scene so many times. It's such a relatable scene because I'm married too.
Yeah.
You do one little thing, it triggers this huge emotional response. Marriage.
I agree. That's good. It was all great. The mall scene where you buy them stuff and it was don't spend that money. It was $4, you know.
Yeah.
Great. And you could charge the card because
Yeah, nobody was going to know. And they had that swipe machine. And the other thing, that the big takeaway is the nostalgia factor. Even my kids told me, and my older son was, 18 or 19 when the book came out. And he said, I know this, I'm not your target audience. He said, but one, I felt like I went into your childhood, and he said, two, he said, I loved all the vintage stuff. Cause it was what would it be like to, 1978. And that's very gratifying because obviously the target audience is more, women of a certain age, people of a certain age, but the nostalgia was super fun, and we cut so much out. Because I had so much, but you couldn't get it all in there. Yeah.
I'm cracking up with the bodysuit.
Oh yeah.
And the snaps.
Yeah, the snaps and the crotch. That's one of my favorite lines in the book. Yeah. But you see
I remember bending over trying to snap those damn things. It was so
yeah. And there's a line that, what if I got overserved later? How could I do the escape hatch?
Right.
Get going in time and not wet myself. Yeah.
True. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was easier to undo it than to do it, but still.
Right.
You had to remember. Yeah.
Right. Especially if you've been transported back in time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what were you going to do with that? So.
Yeah. And, the whole thing about suspense was like, well, how are you going to get back? You know, like. But then there they were. It was just very seamless. Yeah.
Right.
Really great.
Well, you know, a couple of people reviewed the book and they wanted time travel. They wanted science. They wanted, you know, they were sadly, you know, because this is obviously not that book where, yeah.
But it was awesome. And when you said the real time travel, like my friend was like, well, can people really do that? And I'm like, I don't think so, but maybe they like, who knows, you know?
Right, right. Well, I read a lot about it just because I wanted to use words like space-time committee. I mean, I was looking for stuff to say. And, you know, there's people who, I mean, that's studied. It's a heavily studied scientific, you know, field, apparently.
Yeah. Well, did you ever read, I loved her book, Diana Gabaldon,
Outlander.
Outlander,
I think so. I've read most every time travel because again, that's not because I wrote this book, but that's my genre. I've seen all the movies, I've watched all the shows. I love the concept of going backwards.
Yeah. She went, I mean, they went from Scotland through the Civil War? No, or maybe the Revolutionary War. I mean, really, like
it right. was,
you know, one book. It was this thick, and she had like 8 of them. Was like a week, do you know?
Right.
There was so much. Well, yours had a lot of detail too. I mean,
mine was 36 hours plus a little, you know, foray on each side of it. But that's all it was, and it, you know, and a lot of those hours are skipped. I sleep, you know, my dog sleep in the middle of the whole thing. So,
well, it was really great. So, for people who want to read something very thought provoking. Entertaining, like you can't put it down. You're just like, oh my god. Yeah. And it just seemed so real. Like it did not see, I remember that you made it up, you know, that you didn't actually do it. Yeah.
Yeah. What a compliment.
Very.
And maybe that's why it has the emotional resonance that it has with me personally, you know, because it felt real. I mean, that's why I came across that way, I guess, because it did feel real to me. So,
yeah. And the conversation and the personalities. I mean, you had your grandparents back and really, I mean, I can't imagine spending 36 hours and having them all alive, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The grandparents and the dog are the things that really get to people. They really resonate, you know, because what would that be like to sit in a room with your grandparents now that you've lived more years and have so many more questions? And, you know, and of course she can't ask those questions because nobody can know who she is.
Right.
You know, but she can see her grandmother. She can, you know, and she looks at them through a different lens. Because again, these are adult people that she thought were perfect and they're not. And that let everyone off the hook again.
Yeah.
I don't have to be perfect in my adult life, because look, these people who loved me desperately were just doing the best they can.
Yeah. But nobody, you know, obviously, again, you made it up. It wasn't real, but that they didn't recognize you, you know, like,
right.
Oh, you're Amy in the 39. No, how many years? However many years that was. I can't.
Yeah.
30.
Yeah. 30. It would have been like 39 years later.
Yeah.
39 years later.
Oh, of course you're Amy. You're not really a cousin. No, you're a big, you know, I mean, you know.
Yeah, I thought about that, and would they recognize me, my adult self? But they would have, because they would have known me until they died. So you know, but they didn't know me yet that way,
right.
I guess. But I don't know, and that's why I had. There's a line where Mom and I are talking in the kitchen when we're in 1978, and it's like she gets a whiff of it though somehow. Like we're having that conversation, and it's almost like, and I say that in the book, it's almost like she knows me better than she thinks she knows me. Like she, as the mother, gets a sense, you know, of there's a sense that we're connected in a way, you know, like you would be with mother child relationship. And yeah. She's like, you know, I wish I could be more like Big Amy and Little Amy, you know. Mm-hmm. And those are like a part of that's unpacking. Mom's reality was different than what I gave her credit for. And that's not because Amy was unkind, Little Amy. It's because she was 10.
Yeah.
I mean, what do we want from her? You know, right. What do I want from her?
Right. I would love to see a picture of what she really looked like. If you ever have
Little Amy?
Yeah.
I'll send you one.
Okay, good. Yeah.
My son did he's like an artist, but he did this great, and I'll send you this. It's a he put a picture of Little Amy and Big Amy together with arms around each other. The real Big Me and the real Little Me.
Oh.
It's probably my favorite photo of the two of us. But I think of Amy, Little Amy, as a real entity after this book. And I think this is, again, relatable. You know, I when Dad died, I was like, oh, I don't want to tell Little Amy because she's going to be really upset. You know, she's going to get, and I really do try to honor Little Amy in my life. And I try to remember who we are and who, she, you know, what she taught me. And I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to make that kid proud of what we're going to do next. You know?
But do you get it like she is you, or do you get it like she is a separate being?
Well, no, I think about it both just because the character of Little Amy, I think about her as being separate, but I feel really fortunate to have Little Amy still on board here inside of me because the Freak Train Express has landed in 2025, you know, and we're still, and now I'm getting to the age where, you know, I can't wait to be like this old woman in my front yard, like sorting recipes in the grass or doing some weird stuff, you know, because I think that honors all the Amys. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. All right. Let's take our commercial break and then we're going to talk about Dear Dana. This is exciting. All right. Okay. All right. Awesome. Be right back.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Welcome back to the Getting Real with Hillary Show. And today we will bring Amy back, but I just want to thank Kikori, our sponsor. They are bringing social-emotional learning to our classrooms and to families. Parents now love Kikori as well. They've taken it home with them, and it actually helps them. Not only do students connect in the classroom to their teachers and classmates, but now parents are connecting more with their children through this platform. So check it out. KikoriApp.com, KIKORIAPP.com. And then for my books, of course, I have my own version of little Hillary. This is my memoir, The Second Piece of French Toast. This was not time travel, but in a sense it was, because there were some flashbacks. And this is how I got out of from the dark side of life to the light. And that's what I talk about in my third book, all the techniques that I discovered when I discovered that there was this other side of life that wasn't a lot of fun, and how to get back to the fun side. And that's in Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. And then this one was when I wrote my first book, one of my first editors said, why didn't you speak up? And why didn't you take responsibility for yourself? And I was like, what? I didn't even know I didn't. So this book is called Real Talk, How I Learned to Speak Up and How to Say the Things You've Never Said so you can have the things you've always wanted. It's not easy if you're a people-pleasing, pleasant phony like me. Everything was fine. And I didn't speak up, but I learned to. So you can go to, I don't know, my website. Hopefully it'll be ready soon, gettingrealwithhillary.com, or my YouTube channel, also Getting Real with Hillary. It has the links. You could sign up for my newsletter. You can go to the books and also subscribe also to my TikToks. All right. And now we are bringing back Amy to talk about her second book. So this one, now when I first met you, so we met like a little while ago to plan, you know, to talk about being on the show. And, you know, she told me the story, but it was like, yeah, whatever. Kind of, you know, didn't really, you know, I mean, it was nice, but I didn't really get it. And then when I read the book, I was like, so, all right. Do you want me to give my version?
Oh yeah, I want to hear. I liked your synopsis of the first one. Yeah. Right.
So this was what? This one was published later, right? So
2022, yes.
So when did you see her first post?
I saw her first post in 2013.
Oh, okay.
That's when Dane and I reconnected on
Facebook. Okay, so it was way before the pandemic. Okay. So Amy sees a post from an old friend that she hadn't talked to in 30 years to pray. I don't know if the first one was to pray for her son who had been diagnosed with cancer. Was that the first mm-hmm. one? Yeah.
Right.
So Amy decides to not only pray, which became a big part. I don't know if you were already praying, but she writes her a handwritten letter. Now, you didn't get a response right away, right? But you...
Right. At the beginning, I wrote her and Parker at the Ronald McDonald House where they were staying in Memphis, at, you know, by St. Jude. And so I wrote the two of them for about 10 to 12 weeks. Then that Parker passes away. No response at all.
Right.
Then Parker passes away. And I think, well, I'm just going to keep writing letters. And I hadn't written anyone a letter in like 30 years at this point. And I'd never had any connection with her. Like, not, I didn't even like or comment on her stuff. Well, I did Facebook message her and tell her I was praying, but it's not because I didn't know her. And this girl was watching her son fight cancer. I felt like that was disingenuous. So after he passed away, he was 15 years old. I was like, what do I do? And then that was just like mini lightning bolt. Oh, I'll just keep writing her the letters. Only now I had to like stalk her husband's law office address because I didn't know where she really lived because this was Facebook. And I felt so invested, like I couldn't stop myself. So I just kept writing her. No response for 4 months. Then she started writing me back. And that's when the whole story kicks off. We became pen pals for 2 years. And
so when she, because this is what I was thinking, that you kept going without any kind of response.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did that take something? Did you think, oh, I should stop? Like, yes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm just a regular person like anybody else. So I felt like I was on a mission to write this person these cards. And I knew the whole time I was doing it, I was like, one, she lost her son. Like, what is this even going to do? Like, this is silly, you know, and just intrusive. But I could not stop myself from doing it. But every time I sat down to do it, and especially the moment for me was when I would stick it in the mailbox, I'd be like, you have lost your mind. You are a nut job, you know, but I could not. There was something so compelling that I had to do it. Wow. But I think the story pivots on something she did, not something I did, is when she wrote me back, because there would be no book. There'd be no conversation. There would be no all the other letters without her taking the time to dutifully write me back. So in her first letter to me, she says, you know, I didn't know I was going to say all that because it was like 8 pages of handwritten stuff. But I feel good, better for writing it. And it was funny how the writing became therapeutic for both of us in much different ways. But there was this incredible free space between the two of us because I had no idea when or even if she was reading what I wrote. And she had no idea about me. So we just opened up. I mean, we would say, we'd say things like, I've never told anybody this, but I know I can trust you. We literally had not had a phone conversation, a text, an email or anything. And we, for 2 years, this is all we did was write these letters. And the other beautiful thing was I had no idea what she, how she voted. I knew she believed in God because she asked for prayer, but I didn't know if she was a Methodist or a Catholic or a, and nor did I care. All I knew is this poor, this sweet woman lost her son and was opening up to me about her whole life. I was telling her all my business, my life from the outside in. That became cathartic because I was like, oh, wait, when you write something down, like, oh, my marriage, blah, blah, blah. You're like, oh, wait, I see it differently now. Mm-hmm. You know, so here we have this incredible experience going on both sides, dropping these things in the mail that I sat back after about, I guess we'd written about 10 months when I sat back and was like, you know, this is this one girl. I think she lives in Louisiana. And what else? And this changed my whole life. So what else is out there with this other, the list of people, all these names, these random names? You know, what happens if I write everyone? And I realize that's all world, like crazy, next level, like all the way up. But it seemed so, it just made sense to me. And I bought stationery. I printed out everyone's name and I shoved them into a box. And I just started writing letters. And I didn't think I was going to finish. And I did not intend to write a book. I didn't intend to do any of those things.
You did?
But
I was wondering if you did it for a book or if
no, it's just
for the book.
Yeah. Well, I journaled the whole thing and I'm glad I did because right about at the 250 letter, 300 letter mark, I was like, wait a second. I realized this is going to be probably the most incredible experience of my entire life. And there's so much hope in this story. And there's so many incredible takeaways from this story that I'm going to have to share this in some way with the world. So I wrote letter 580. That was the finish. And I stopped taking friend requests at the end. It's 18 months it took me to write the letters. So I wrote 580 handwritten letters. Wow. Plus I was writing Dana at the same time. And the next morning I got up relieved beyond measure that I was not going to write another letter because I'd had it. I was done in a bunch of different ways. And I wrote the first four chapters of Dear Dana that next morning because I was just completely convinced now I have my mission is to go out and share the story. And that's still my mission.
Wow. I mean, the whole Dana thing is one thing. And then, you know, that you didn't stop. It seems like you were just driven, like you just had to do it. And like, even when you took that month off and you went to the race, like that was met them.
Yeah. Yeah. I met him for the first time and we went to the St. Jude Marathon. She invited us and she said from their end, they were like, well, this could go either way. Like this could be great or this could be a disaster, you know? And I was the same way. I was completely on edge about what this was going to look like after 2 years of writing each other. And I'll tell you what, we just fell into to pace with each other. And I talk to her every day now. Wow. She's my best friend. So
it seemed like her daughters gave you the perspective that you didn't have, that she shared with you what she, like you didn't, I don't know if you didn't know it, but it's like you were kind of like, yeah, I just write these letters. But then it was like, no, I'm a place for her to be able to say what she doesn't say to people. Right.
Right. And it's a great testament to, because you're exactly right that I was writing the letters and I didn't know because she didn't tell me that in the letters. Mm-hmm. She didn't tell me that until, you're right, her daughters told me when we met in Memphis, when I first met everybody. One of them pulled me aside and it was like, I don't know what's going on with the letters, but this is a good thing for mom. Mm. You know, and I was like, this is crazy. She's like, you are right, but let's keep going. You know, like nobody's ever asked me to do anything from that family. Not one person has ever asked me for anything. But what I didn't know, so here's my perception is she's getting these letters. She lost her son. She's devastated. This is dumb. Like what I'm doing can't even do anything. And this is a great testament to, we don't know what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Like we just need to go with our gut probably for the most part.
Yeah.
And so, but from her perspective, I didn't know that they were waiting for the letters to come. They were literally waiting for the letters. Like, when's the next letter going to come? Mom, she's not going to stop writing you, is she? Because they're all at home, even though the daughters are older than Parker that passed away. They all went back home and sat there with Jim and Dana and tried to take care of each other. They were still going to college, but they were driving an hour each way so they could be together. Because it was like devastation. And so they would wait for the letters to come. And then she got to read it first. And then they would all read the letters. And then she told me, and the girls told me after the fact, that if she walked into a room and they're all doing life together and everybody seemed like they were okay at that moment and she wasn't, she, and this is her own words, rather than bring the room down, she would go write me a letter and she'd write about her grief. Because I was this safe space to deposit all this stuff. Wow. And since I didn't know what to say, and these letters were going back and forth in the mail, and it wasn't like a text where I had to say, oh, I'm so sorry. I had a neighbor across the street who'd lost her husband suddenly. And she would always tell me, the best thing you can tell to somebody who's grieving is, that sucks. So that's all I would say. I'm praying for you, and that sucks. I am so sorry. But I didn't try to pontificate on the grief. I just said that. And she just not unloaded at all. She just shared about how that felt. And so the other thing that happened to me is I learned a lot about grief and what we can and can't do. She just taught me a lot. And I had no idea they were waiting for those letters. I thought I was being ridiculous, and it was a lifeline. I was throwing them a lifeline every week. And I was so compelled that I always mailed it on the same day and always got to them on the same day. And I think they worried if it didn't come. I had no idea.
And also that they were afraid you were going to stop.
Right. And because the one daughter, the same one that pulled me aside in Memphis, she said, Mom, do you think the letters are ever going to stop? And she said they both cried. And Dana said, I hope they never stop. And I still write Dana. So, wow. And it's that story. And the book people were like, is it two separate stories or it's one story? And to me, it's one story because in living it, I never wouldn't have written one Facebook letter without seeing the power of it in my own life with Dana. It's such a connected story. And I tell Dana all the time that the reason, like those 508 letters unleashed this incredible amount of good into the world. Because when you reach out in an intentional way like that with nothing, like I'm not asking you for anything. I don't want you to join anything. I don't want you to buy anything. I'm just going to send you a letter. And then in writing the letters, I figured out that, you know, what am I going to say? Well, the first thing I would say in one of these letters was, this is why I'm doing this. But then I would say, like, say I'm writing you and we went to high school together. I'd be like, oh my gosh, I'd have to go look at your profile and see what you were actually doing. And I'd be like, oh my God, you're a rock star. Look at you with your, look at you with your podcast and the things you do. Look what you do. You know, you're incredible. So I'd be like, oh my God, you're a rock star. You know, I'm proud of you. I'm proud that we were friends. And then the second part, I still have another page. I'd be like, so what happened? Like, what did Hillary and I do? And I'd be like, oh my God, when Larry broke up with me in front of the payphone in high school, Hillary got right up in my business and she was like, you know what? This is not going to define you relationally. And you were being yourself now back then. And you know what? I never thanked you for that. And so then I get to thank you for that. Mm. And so you think about those two things together, realizing these people are individuals that maybe something that happened, like your mom had passed away. I get to say, I'm sorry for that. I get to say you're a rock star. And then I get to say, hey, thanks for being my friend in 1979. And think about receiving a letter like that, but think about what it would feel like to write 600 of those letters.
Yeah.
That's why I can't shut my mouth, Hillary. You know, it's, but then when you get a handwritten letter from someone in 2025 or a note, two sentences in a card, people are going to realize the amount of effort and sacrifice it took for you to do that. Cause you got to find a stamp. You got to write stuff down. Wait, where are the addresses?
And
that
works.
Yeah. And you got to get in your minivan and drive across town and drop that thing in a blue box somewhere. And people are going to feel valued. They're going to feel valued and important. And I realized that 600 times plus Dana and I's letters, which are profoundly moving to me. And I realized that this is a little tool we have in our little human toolkit that is absolutely unbelievably powerful because people responded to letters in a way that just didn't make any sense. They were so moved by them, you know?
Now you said, because now we have, so this is what I don't know if you'd say grappling with, but like, first of all, a few things. I would have been worried about what they thought of me. Was I crazy? Mm-hmm. And I know you said some people were like, what do you want? You know, are you going to ask me for money and stuff like that? Like, I would have been worried about that. But also, I know you just, like you said, just for the good. Like, there was no expectation. There was nothing you expected back. If they didn't write back, that was fine. Like, how did you get yourself to that place?
Well, part of it was not because I'm some great person, but it was because the numbers game. You know, if you write one letter, it's one thing. If you write 600, you can't keep up with it anyway. So it matters less. But also I realized just in talking to people after the fact that if someone responded, it didn't mean that it meant more to them than it did to somebody who didn't respond. Right. And I realized with a letter, you're not asking for anything. So really you shouldn't expect anything. And that freed me from wanting a response to know I made a difference. And that was one of the major takeaways for me. We can make an absolute difference in other people's lives without them responding one thing to us. And if we can get ourselves on that level, but I got myself only because it was a numbers game, because I couldn't keep up.
Right.
I think if I would have written 10 letters, I wouldn't have had that same takeaway, you know, but now I write people and I care. Like if I get a response back, I'm so happy if I get some in my mailbox, but I don't, that's not what the game is for me, because I understand the power it has.
And you were also so generous, like with, I'll just say with your love, like it didn't seem like I'd be like, if I tell someone I love them, like what if they think I'm a jerk? You know what I mean? Like I would have been,
no.
Of course, worried about that. Like were you just free with it? Or did you go like, well, what am I doing? You know, like.
Well, at the beginning, I struggled. And it's almost like the letters to Dana. Every time I drop one in a box, I was like, what are you doing? You just wrote Mrs. Atwood from third grade. You've lost all of your marbles, you know? And I felt that way over and over again. But when I started getting people's responses and realized that, you know, when you tell someone you care about them or you value them, it's never too late to say it. If it's sincere and it's in your heart, it's absolutely never the wrong thing to say. But part of the reason I was able to do that, Hillary, is because the way a handwritten note or letter and a mailbox works. Like I don't ever have to watch you open it. I don't know when you opened it. I don't know when you read it. And the same reason I could say stuff to Dana I couldn't say out loud in my real life is the reason I could tell Hillary Burns from, you know, ninth grade that I loved her. Because I do. And I feel that way about you. But I don't even know if you're ever going to read that. And I don't have to watch your reaction. I'm free from all that. I have no idea.
Wow. Yeah, I was just like, wow. You know, but I know like when I started doing TikToks or the YouTube videos way back 2019, it was like I would go to hit send or whatever, publish. And it was like there was this vulnerability, like people are going to see me in it. I still have it a little, but not as much after 6 years. But it's just, I guess it's being vulnerable. Like you were allowing yourself to be vulnerable.
And I think people responded to that too, because they realized that. And especially, you know, the written letter was, you know, my spelling's not great. My handwriting's kind of crappy, you know, and I think that lended to the whole thing. Because what more comforting thing is there than realizing everybody else's life is messed up too? It's messed up and it's beautiful and it's messy and it's all, you know, and letting people know that. I mean, it's so comforting. And I think people, again, it's not because I'm some kind of incredible person. It was the whole way. It's just this, the universe or God or whatever you want to call it, gave me this incredible experience to share. You know, and that's what it is. It's not about people going to write 600 letters. You know, it's about maybe using this somewhere in your life of human relationships.
Yeah. Wow. So I give you so much credit and thank you. I want to ask two questions. A, what's next? And B, you know, what would you like to leave people with? How would you, I know they can get your books. They can get Dear Dana, which is incredible. They're both incredible, very different, but just really wonderful reads. Get them for yourself or for, You Cannot Mess This Up, by Amy Wineland Daughters, if you can't find Amy Daughters. But yeah, so I'll shut up and let you answer the gosh darn questions. Go ahead. If you remember what they are.
Yeah, I know the second one was what I want to leave people with.
Yeah.
What was the first one again?
What's next?
Oh, what's next? Oh, I'm working on a humorous historical fiction book, which I'm very excited about. Cool. You know, kind of turn historical fiction, like learn some things, but also laugh out loud. You know, so we'll see how that goes. Because I speak about letter writing now all the time. So it cuts into my writing time. And the obvious takeaway would be go write a handwritten note, but I think I'm going to go bigger than that. And it's, you know, both these stories, and I'm not tooting my own horn here. The thing I'm proudest of with both my books is this, that, you know, is I found a way, or the universe found a way, to spur me on to some ridiculous idea that was inside of me that I felt like was ridiculous, that I just decided, hey, I'm going to go for it. And I had a great little tribe of people supporting me, including my spouse and my children, you know, cheering me on. But I would just encourage people, what's the idea inside of you? And take your own. And I love the title of your book about bullshit, because I always say, just take your own crap seriously enough, just long enough. Your bullshit is your blessing. And that is kind of my mantra. Like, just take your own crap seriously enough, just long enough to do something you feel like is a little crazy. And if we all just encourage each other to do that, what would this world look like?
Mm. Wow. Yeah. But in a good way, crazy in a good way.
No, no. And I say crazy. And when the book people, they were like, you can't use the word crazy that much because I'm not speaking of, you know, I'm not, and I'm not speaking, you know, flippantly about mental illness or anything like that. What I'm saying is what you know inside of you, it's back to what you said when you're going to say those stuff in the letters. What will people think of me? What will people say? And we answer those what ifs, like, what if this is my big chance to do something that means something, that adds meaning somehow? Mm-hmm. And whatever that idea is, whatever that idea is, and then being that person, especially in the context of women, that encourages the other person to do their idea.
Mm.
That's the greatest person you can be.
Yeah. Take the neck. Do it. Do it anyway.
Jump off. Yeah.
Do it anyway, even though, like you said, you might think it's ridiculous. So.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Amy. Thank you for who you are. Thank you for your beautiful writing, for your lessons to all of us. And just appreciate you being here. Anything?
Well, this is an honor to be on. I enjoyed our conversation. I thank you very much.
Yes, you're very welcome. Thank you. All right. See you, everyone.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.